Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Pianci. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Cass?
I'm doing great. We're joined by one of our favorite guests of all time, Molly White. Thank you for coming back and joining us today. How are you?
Doing well. Always happy to come back on the show.
It's always nice to have you. And today we're talking about a topic near and dear to my heart. We're discussing a few things that I think are really fun. We're discussing a book. The book is Read, Write, Own. The author is Chris Dixon, who, if you're unfamiliar with him, he has quite a presence on X, formerly Twitter. I think he has something like 500,000 followers or something like that, maybe 400,000, something like that. He is a partner for Andreessen Horowitz, A16Z. They are a venture capital firm that has made a lot of moves in the cryptocurrency and tech space in general. They really have pushed Web3 and this notion of how it's saving the internet. And with that, with the just broad explanation of what we're jumping into here, I have not read that book. My co-host Bennett has, and Molly has. And the reason we wanted to have Molly on today is because her review really encapsulated what I expected this book to be. So we're going to link to her review. It's a review, Chris Dixon's Read, Write, Own. Prominent crypto venture capitalist Chris Dixon provides an unconvincing Bible for blockchain solutionists. Molly, you took the time to get into the weeds of this, as you call it, biblical prophecy for blockchain. Why didn't it convince you?
Chris Dixon is doing what, as you mentioned, Andreessen Horowitz has done for a long time now, which is they really like to focus, or at least some of them really like to focus on the idea that blockchains are the solution to all the problems with the web, which has always been something that like really gets my interest because I'm also really interested in the web and things that are wrong with it and ways that it could become better. And so I was really interested in reading sort of a long form explanation of things that they've been really saying for a long time, like in their blog posts, which are prolific. You know, they go on podcasts and say all this stuff. And it's always been really unconvincing because they sometimes do identify actual problems, you know, that, you know, big tech is taking over the web and so much of what we see is filtered through the algorithms of Google and Twitter and Facebook and all this stuff, which like there are legitimate complaints there. But then they just sort of jump to this idea that blockchain will solve those problems with really poor explanations of how they might solve those problems or how they might not introduce a lot of new problems. And in this book in particular, you know, a lot of what they were talking about was in the sort of 2020, 2021 era where things were still a little bit nascent as far as people building these web products on Ethereum. But now Dixon has come out with a book in 2024 after a lot of projects have tried to do the very things that he is saying blockchains will be well suited for, and they've failed at it spectacularly. And he doesn't mention those in the book. You know, he just talks about like, oh, someday someone will do these things. And so, you know, I was really disappointed in the book because I was hoping for maybe at least an honest reflection on what's happened and what's gone wrong. And oh, you know, maybe there are these problems we didn't think about. But there was really none of that. It was a lot of the same stuff they've been saying. You know, it was as if it was published in 2020 with no sort of benefit of experience.
You mentioned there that he doesn't address the failures. And one of the almost stranger dynamics to me was how, in some sense, failures were passed off as if they were not that, right? Like he had a whole several paragraph section where he was talking about how Helium was a good example of how tokens can help you get around the bootstrap problem. But no one uses Helium.
Except for all the poor rubes who bought the routers or whatever they call them, the hotspots. Like there was some market for that.
I guess his argument there is you can take advantage of sufficiently stupid people if you make vague promises in front of them, and that can save you money on infrastructure build,
I guess.
This actually brings me to a pretty interesting thought that I'm having where it's just like, okay, we know A16Z, Bennett, I hope you link to, Bennett wrote this article for Protos. He went over every A16Z investment, and a lot of them were very, very poor investments. And I think Bennett, did they invest in Axie Infinity?
They invested in Sky Mavis when Sky Mavis launched Axie Infinity.
If we want to look at the failures of the companies that they invest in, and I understand this is a part of venture capital, right? Like venture capital, most of it's going to be failures. Most of it is going to be companies that don't succeed in one way or another. They might not be scams, but they don't do what they think they're going to do. It seems like it would be quite valuable, actually, to go into the depths of that. If you want a book that people are going to read and actually learn from, I guess, it seems like, especially as a venture capitalist who's
who
made
that,
don't you think that'd be a more interesting book? Am I wrong?
I'm just jumping ahead to your conclusion that an interesting book that people are actually going to read was not the goal here.
Right.
Molly, you called it essentially biblical, and I think I get that. I'm getting that understanding as well. Everyone that's sort of described it has called it like almost like religious in a sense. Even the positive ones are kind of like it doesn't sound like it uses hard data to back up his claims or anything right. like that. What do you think was the goal of this book ultimately?
Well, I really found myself wondering that when I was reading it, because there are so many parts in it where it's pretty clear who it's not for, you know, who he's not writing the book for. He's not writing it for skeptics, very clearly. He insults them at several points throughout the book. You know, anyone who tries to fact check some of the claims will easily find errors. So it's really not meant for like an adversarial reader. I don't think it's really meant for even someone who has not made up their mind on crypto and is open to maybe there's some possible use cases here, unless they're very sort of uncritical, because he'll say things as though they're fact, as though they are just like well accepted truths, and not bother to back up the argument or cite any data or anything. He'll just say things and then move right on, and you're like, wait a minute, I needed more there. I needed to know, you know, what you were saying and why I should believe that. So I ended up feeling like the book is really just written for people who either already agree with him and are just looking to sort of be like, yes, this is exactly right. Yeah, or for people who just, you know, looking to have someone tell them what to believe without really putting much thought into it. And then I think there's also, you know, as far as the goal of the book, I think there is a strong chance that he's really just hoping that he can say, look at my best-selling book. I'm clearly so authoritative on this topic because I, you know, topped the New York Times list or, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to do. So clearly everything I said in this book must be true and must be well accepted and must be well reasoned because it was, you know, topping the charts and all this kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of that. You know, it's more credible to be able to say, look, I published a book with Penguin Random House than to say, look at my blog posts. Although I think, you know, they do a fair amount of look at my blog posts as well. But, you know, I think it's really just to sort of lend credibility to this idea that blockchains are the future of the web. And here is the, you know, you don't even have to read it, but just look at, there's this book here, and this would explain it if you bothered to read it.
It's a document for crypto venture firms' general partners to send to their limited partners to convince them it's still worth sending the general partners more money. That's really kind of feels like what it is. No, crypto's still here. Crypto's still good. Things are still going great. Just look. The book says so.
We'll jump into the New York Times bestseller list aspect of this shortly, but I do want to propose that this, because I similar to you, Molly, that was my kind of thought, was that this was a marketing campaign and a way to make blockchain and Web3 sound quite viable still, especially during this crazy run during, like, everyone's talking about AI and, you know, large language models, like everyone has other things they're thinking about right now that aren't cryptocurrency. So reminding everyone that all these companies exist and have billions of dollars poured into them. Sure. I think that's a huge part of it. But then Wall Street Journal wrote an article in October of 2022 titled Andreessen Horowitz Went All In on Crypto at the Worst Possible Time. Chris Dixon, a partner who led the charge, says he has a very long-term horizon. Basically, this is an article saying that Chris Dixon's investments suck. I am curious if A16Z said, listen, buddy, your investments are tanking. Write a book get some marketing push onto the companies that you have invested in and try to claw back some of this cash that you have unwisely spent. I think there could be truth to that. Obviously, I'm not going to say that's for sure true, but like, it just feels like a possibility to me, I guess. And from the way you guys are describing the book, I still feel that way. It's, and also like a morale booster to all these companies that they've invested in, that they're handing this book out to them and saying like, see, we still care. We still believe in you or whatever. But yeah, Bennett, you also read the book, so I'd like to hear some of your thoughts as well.
My thoughts echo many of Molly's in that I think that this was primarily an exercise in narrative shaping in the way that Andreessen Horowitz loves to do. They are not the most technical investors. They don't emphasize due diligence as much as some other firms. What their focus has been for much of their existence has been in trying to invest in and shape narratives to their own financial benefit. And as we've already established, they have existing large investments in various cryptocurrency projects and firms. And well, a significant portion of their crypto portfolio is now ostensibly AI companies after a series of pivots that some of them are still at least claiming to be focused on crypto. And so, yes, helping to shape a narrative, return the focus, especially if you time it with like Sam Bankman-Fried is somewhat out of the news cycle right now.
That's true.
ETFs have been approved. There are certain positive indicators. And there's an election coming up, which means one, it is unlikely we get any substantial crypto legislation passing before January of 2025. Second, it means that you may feel it is advantageous to force various candidates to come up with stances about your MacGuffin, especially if you're worried the current administration doesn't have very positive feelings towards your MacGuffin. And so I think primarily the book and the marketing campaign around it is all about trying to keep crypto in the narrative, because there was this kind of, we talked about this before in kind of the context of FTX and SBF, following that there's been an increasing resolve among certain regulators to push crypto away from like some of the financial centers, right? The banks started doing it even before FTX, but SEC and CFTC both kind of indicated they were pushing crypto further away following FTX. And so I think the book exists to help A16Z's crypto investments first and foremost.
I would also add actually one thing about timing that I think is interesting. I think because we're coming up into an election year, Trump is going to be a candidate. There's going to be a lot of conversations about the web is broken, misinformation, especially AI, deep fakes, things like that, that are going to be used to try to influence the election. And I think that a big narrative that we're going to be seeing is that blockchains will fix everything that's wrong with the web that we are seeing so starkly, you know, demonstrated by the absolute nonsense that happens on the web around election years. So I think the timing is not entirely coincidental, because there's about to be, I think, a lot of conversations about, you know, trustworthiness on the web, social media, big tech, etc. And this will be a good opportunity for Andreessen Horowitz to continue the arguments that Dixon makes in the book, which is that blockchains will fix social media. It will fix disinformation. It will fix even AI. He really, I didn't go into this in my review because my review was already getting pretty long, but he talks about AI a lot in the book.
Oh.
And
kind of.
It's in the same sort of way that he talks about a lot of things, where he states as fact that like AI is the next big thing, and you know, it's gonna totally change how art, you know, and artists do business and all this stuff. But he talks about blockchains as a solution to all the problems that AI will introduce. So he's, you know, he's really, I think, looking for the timely conversations to sort of reinsert the argument that blockchains will solve this, even though, you know, history has not been friendly towards that narrative.
Before we get into the other couple aspects of this book, I just wanted to question, like, I know when I said I made a point, I tweeted out something about like how funny it was to me, like in an ironic sense, that they had taken out a full page ad in the Washington Post. Okay. And then also that he's publishing a book on paper, on physical paper, like that this is funny to me in some sense, regardless. And a reporter from The Block, I believe, Colin Willem. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. But he said, this doesn't surprise me that they're doing this. Think about who they're trying to reach with this advertising. It is politicians and lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And I was like, oh, yeah, I mean, like that. It's a good point, even though I still think it's ironic and funny. And I wonder if did this book have like did it feel like politics was being breached, or was it just vaguely like in the background?
He does talk about legislation and the ways that he thinks legislation could, you know, hurt the crypto industry and the future of blockchains that he's, you know, talking about. I think more than anything, he's hoping that the existence of the book will influence regulators, politicians, etc. I don't think he's actually hoping that politicians and lobby or that regulators will read the book, because there's not actually that much in there about regulation and stuff. So, you know, maybe he would hope that they would buy into his idea that, you know, in order to do all these wonderful things, we need to have, you know, light touch regulation, which is sort of briefly what he says, although he doesn't actually really illustrate what he thinks regulation should look like. He says it should exist, but it shouldn't be securities regulations. And that's kind of as far as he goes. But yeah, I think it's really just he wants to be able to point at the book and say this, you know, again, if you were to read this, you would be so convinced about everything I have to say. And I know you don't have the time, you know, don't worry about it, but it's there if you were to care to look, is I think the goal, really.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really excellent point. It almost feels at times like apolitical, like divorced from certain like political things, and like trying to avoid making certain political stances so that it serves yes. as kind of everything for anyone who reads it, right? And A16Z, talking about their blog post, does have relatively detailed blog posts on how they feel about certain specific pieces of legislation you can look up. And none of that kind of substance makes it into the book. It is, like Molly mentioned, all just like, don't regulate this out of existence or you'll regret it. Can't use laws from the 1930s on our tokens, and our tokens aren't currencies, they're tokens, we insist. And so, yeah, it felt almost like kind of trying to avoid being political and acting just as a legitimizing exercise. We're not all Sam Bankman-Fried. Some of us are best-selling authors.
And some of us don't even like Sam Bankman-Fried, actually. You know, and we don't like the casinos and all the stuff that we can sort of say is bad crypto.
But also, don't try to regulate the casino out of existence, because the casino needs to exist for our very serious things like, let me check my list here, investments in NFT cockfighting to pay off.
God, that one's one of my favorite ones. Mecha cockfighting, actually.
Sure, sure. The chickens are robots. That makes
they're
it
robots.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I think that's super true. I think also it's very clear throughout the book that it's like there are points where you can see him really carefully not pissing people off. Like there are so many points where he's being so careful to not make Bitcoiners mad, even though it's pretty clear that he doesn't love Bitcoin all that much. And he's very clearly an Ethereum guy.
And he still trips up in a couple times by like crossing the Bitcoin mythos by like saying that
yes.
miners are the ones responsible for validating instead of like pointing to nodes, which is a thing that any Bitcoiners who actually bothered to read the book, which won't be many of them, would immediately be upset at him with.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I think would piss off Bitcoiners, but like you can see him very carefully trying to like tread the line to make the book as acceptable to like the widest audience possible.
And we're talking about in a lot of this how much of the book is light and abstract. And that is true even when he's talking about like the book's primary topic. Like when he's talking about blockchains and what they are and what they're supposed to do, he's like wrong in weird ways,
yes.
like when he talks about things, like he assumes blockchains are always forward compatible, which is not true. Bitcoin has removed a bunch of opcodes, so if you built something relying on those opcodes, your program breaks. Ethereum has done a variety of breaking changes over its time that have caused smart contracts to stop functioning. There are further future-breaking changes planned for Ethereum, like state rent and things like that, that will invalidate how a bunch of smart contracts work. But he just says you can build something now confident it will continue to run that way into the future. And it's just objectively not true.
Right. And that he argues that like blockchains can't be changed, basically, that the code of a blockchain can't be changed. And like, it's again, just that's just not true. And it's not clear necessarily if he's saying that it can't be changed like hard stop, or if it can't be changed without community consensus. And he's just making these really broad assumptions about what that consensus would be, and that it would always favor his particular interests, which are not necessarily aligned with every person's interests. I would argue that Andreessen Horowitz's interests are often very opposed to the interests of other people in the crypto world, and that there is a very strong possibility that, you know, a blockchain could change in a way that would disadvantage their interests. But, you know, there's just no discussion of that. He just makes these like bold statements that like blockchains can't change, and then moves right on.
And does like a similar thing with other fundamental things for blockchains, like security. He like just hand waves away the issue of like all of blockchain security. And he's like, you may sometimes hear about things being attacked, but that's Ethereum Classic and Bitcoin SV, and never the top chains, ignoring like Binance proposing a rollback on Bitcoin, or the infinite minting bug on Binance, or the fucking DAO hack and the resulting hard fork, a massive irregular state transition.
Infinite minting bug on Bitcoin, just so people don't. Yeah. I think we've talked about that before. But sorry, I just wanted to clarify that.
Or like, there was a point in Bitcoin's history where like 1/3 of the miners upgraded to like one version, but the rest didn't. And there was like a chain split for a while because there was some minor incompatibility in the way the two versions work, which caused like one of the miner who was running like 1/4 to 1/3 of the hash rate to have to roll back to an older version to rejoin the majority chain, which was on the older client. And like, none of that counts, I guess. None of that happened.
It's funny because there's been so many books that we've looked into. I still think Nathaniel Popper's Digital Gold is a great resource. We've talked about David Girard's Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain, which I think is a fun read and provides a lot of great resources, actually.
Holds up really well, given that it was written in like 2017.
yeah. And just the idea of like actually going on Bitcoin talk forums and stuff like that, and like actually listing these websites and these forum pages where people could actually go back and look at the history of this stuff as it's happening if they were so inclined to. I think stuff like that is great. And obviously Zeke Fox with his recent book, I think that was also excellent as well. So I think there's plenty of examples out there. And there's Laura Shin's book about the Ethereans was good too. There's a lot of good books out there about blockchains or crypto or whatever.
Going infinite.
And then there's going infinite.
Which I also reviewed.
Yes, me as well. Yes, Molly and I both reviewed that.
I'm in chapter five.
Yeah, you're stuck there still.
There's a couple things I kind of want to interject on. There's this very strange dynamic for me reading this book, Molly, and I think you might have experienced the same. Chris Dixon is older than the two of us, but like the way he talks about the internet feels strange to me, because he talks about like things being dead that I remember experience and still experience, like RSS is dead and blogs are dead and websites are dead and all these many, many things are dead. And like, I can see the shadow of what his argument could be. Like, he's right. Trying to point to the centralization and these gatekeepers in these things. But then, like, I go and I listen to Chris Dixon on a podcast distributed on RSS, and I'm like, this feels like someone building on a protocol network, but what would I know? I'm not a venture capitalist. Did you have any of that kind of tension where, like, Chris Dixon's perspective on the web feels like it's coming from some very strange place?
Yeah, I actually wrote, like, basically a full-length blog post that I ended up cutting from the review, just about how sort of ahistorical his view of the web and the internet and other sort of protocols is. There's a lot in there. He spends the first 1 to 2 parts of the book reviewing the early internet, some of the technology that's involved in the internet stack. He actually gets kind of technical in there, like more than I expected him to, given what I thought the audience would be, you know, talking about what things were like in the early internet. And, you know, he was presumably there, you know, he's older like than I was. I was not really in the early internet per se. But it's incredibly like warped his sort of view of the early internet. And I think I was actually having a conversation on Mastodon, ironically, which he says is dead.
Also dead.
With someone about this, someone who was also, you know, is closer to Chris Dixon's age and was saying that, you know, they were around too in that time period and saw things very differently. And I think honestly, what happened is that Chris Dixon remembers a version of the early internet and didn't really, because of that, he just sort of assumes that's how it was for everyone and doesn't really go into researching more than that. And so he describes this very rose-colored glasses view of the early internet where anyone could just dial up and, you know, search whatever they wanted, which, no, first of all, it was hard to find things back then, you know, and they could write, you know, in the later days of the internet, they could just like buy a URL and, you know, spin up a web server and write whatever they wanted, and Google wasn't the intermediary where search was making it so that you were getting deranked, and, you know, Facebook's algorithm wasn't there, and like all this stuff about how it was this beautiful early days of the internet, which, like, I know a lot of people who have these rose-colored sort of views on the early days of the internet, and there is some truth there. Like, there were some really cool things about the early days of the internet and this sort of hacker ethos, and it was this sort of adversarial time with some regulators and all this stuff, but also, like, a lot of people didn't have access to that. Like, so many people couldn't get on the internet back then. It wasn't that anyone could log on and make a search and do whatever. I was looking up the numbers on this. He defines Web 1 as ending in 2005, which is kind of arbitrary, but like that's a fairly acceptable statement to make. He's like, 1990 to 2005 is Web 1. In 2005, 15% of people were online. That's it. He's saying anyone could log on. Even today, two-thirds of people are online. There's a whole third of the globe that does not have internet access. So stating that that in 2005, anyone had access to the web and didn't have to deal with all this stuff that big tech is gating and all that stuff is just completely ahistorical. And even today, like, there's so many people who just don't have access to that. But I would argue that it's actually a good thing that today many more people have access to the web than they did in 2005. And so we've actually made some strides since then. It's not all bad.
And I'll even argue that, like, self-hosting a reasonably full-featured website is easier in 2024 than 2005.
Like, I was writing about this like 2 years ago where I was saying that, like, actually the web's pretty cool. Like, people are, I actually have a blog post in the works on this. It's like, yes, the web is broken. I think most people will agree with that. Also, the web is better than it's ever been, right? Mm. Like, those two things are both true. And, you know, there are ways that I think we could clearly improve the web. I don't think that the web will ever be fixed, because fixed means something totally different to every person. And what I think is fixed is very different from what Andreessen Horowitz thinks is fixed. but, you know, there are actually really cool things that you can do today that allow you to have total ownership over what you are doing on the web. That's another blog post that I have in the works, but the idea of like ownership is very different. And we could, I don't know if you want to go into that or not.
I mean, we might as well just jump right into that, because I think that one of the things I was talking about, I tweeted something out about, like, I love these property rights on the blockchain people, because they talk about it like there wasn't property rights before the block. It's like, you guys understand, we've managed property rights and ownership for thousands and thousands of years. Like, this, the concept isn't new, and being able to deal with it, we don't need a blockchain to do it. And I think Chris Dixon would hard argue that I'm wrong in that sense, because the title of his book is Read, Write, Own. For anyone who's unfamiliar, I think, like, read, write is that it's like a common, like, common parlance in tech, where it's like about, read and write capabilities for when you're publishing and doing stuff. Yeah.
In the context of the book, he divides like Web 1 into your reading, and Web 2, you're writing and interacting. And in Web 3, you get to own the assets, the property.
Yeah. But one note that I made when I was reading was that I realized at some point that Chris Dixon's view of ownership is like really different than mine. Like, I own a lot of things in theory. Chris Dixon, it seems like, only really believes you own something if you can resell that thing. And so like I own my dog, right? Technically, I don't love that, like that term, but it's, you know, it's how people talk about it. But I'm not going to resell my dog, right? I own the milk in my fridge. I'm not going to resell the milk in my fridge. You know, I own the content that I publish on Wikipedia. I'm not going to sell that, right? Like, there's a lot of stuff that I think I own that Chris Dixon would be like, oh no, you don't own your dog. You know, you don't own the milk in your fridge, which is like, he very much believes that until you can like wrap something that you have created into a token, you don't truly own it. This is also something that comes up with his top talk of like ownership in terms of content creation, which I think is really interesting, where he talks about how you don't own the stuff that you post on Twitter. And he talks about how Twitter takes like Facebook, Twitter, a couple different platforms, he says, takes like a 99% take rate, which is just completely fiction. Like this is actually something that Andreessen Horowitz makes the same claim in those State of Crypto reports. So I'd already addressed this a long time ago, but like when he talks about take rates, he's talking about several different things and he just calls them all take rates. One of them is like the take rate of, you know, you publish something on Substack, Substack takes 10% of your subscription revenue. That's like a normal way to look at a take rate. But then he talks about like 99% take rates on Twitter. Or maybe bad example now that Twitter is like monetizing some things, but he's really just talking about like platforms where people publish stuff with no expectation of return. And then he says that the advertising money that the company is making is like the take rate, and it allows him to really juice the numbers to like make it sound like current web platforms have this like astronomical take rate. But when he's talking about ownership, he's really only saying that like if you can't make money off of it, you don't own it, which I think is just like kind of an offensive way to talk about creation because it's so financialized.
And even in that same vein, he seems okay with not really owning it as long as you can profit from it. Like in the section about NFTs, when he's talking about like the rights and like the individual prints themselves, he has some understanding that the NFT itself is like just the NFT and doesn't necessarily represent ownership of some other thing, but he still seems to think it's valuable purely because it can be like bought and resold and valued in that way. And so even when the thing you own isn't actually like a thing you own, he thinks you own it if you can potentially profit from it in the future.
Right. And he also makes a lot of assumptions, I think, that are really interesting around how blockchains would enable ownership somehow like out of the box that are not really true. And conversely, about how you can't do those things today. I was literally just talking to someone about this, about the idea of like owning your audience, which I also think is a really weird term, like owning your relationship with your readers or whatever. It's like weird to call that ownership, but that's kind of a side point. But like, I recently just moved my blog from Substack onto my own self-hosted thing. And I was able to do that without having to get every single person who subscribed to my writing to resubscribe, because the payments are made to me. And then like Substack takes a cut of that. But it's still a relationship that is sort of with me directly. And so I was able to like move to a different platform because that's how that's set up. And that's a really good way of setting things up. I have a lot of complaints about Substack, but like that is really good that they do that. And I think lots of places should do that so that if you want to start writing somewhere else, you can just switch out the platform and nothing really changes for your readers, for your payment relationships, anything like that. That's awesome. And that's what Chris Dixon is really envisioning when he's talking about these creator audience relationships. And he talks about how blockchains will enable this somehow, as though there's not, like, as though it's impossible to set up a relationship that is more traditional big tech, where it's the platform that owns those relationships and they don't come with you, because it is possible to have that kind of platform built on a blockchain. Like, there's nothing about blockchains that stops you from doing that. He just sort of makes these assumptions that all blockchain platforms will be set up in a way where there is a more advantageous relationship between subscribers and creators.
I think there's like existing counterexamples. Like, I don't think BitClout DeSo, you can like easily and automatically port your following from BitClout over to some other platform just because it's recorded on the blockchain.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's super, there's nothing about this like sort of network level technology that prevents platforms, as he says, that prevents platforms from building on it in a way that is sort of a walled garden. And there's nothing about current, you know, non-blockchain technologies that prevent people from not doing that. And so I just find that really disingenuous because I totally agree with him that the model should be improved in a lot of ways so that so that people are not so dependent on these platforms and so that there isn't this sort of control there that keeps people locked in to using some of these platforms. But the blockchain question is sort of a side thing. Like that's not really an important part of it, in my opinion.
In that vein, as a Wikipedian, how did you feel about the way he handled, addressed, and almost dismissed the Wikipedia model?
So Chris Dixon actually likes Wikipedia more than a lot of these types of folks do. A lot of them just hate Wikipedia, and he's not one of them, which, like, credit to him on that one. But he does talk about Wikipedia in really weird ways where he, like, he talks about it as though it is this completely unique edge case that like could never be replicated, which is, I mean, I understand where he's coming from. It is pretty unique and people really haven't replicated it in ways that they've certainly tried to. But he attributes the success of Wikipedia to like, oh, but it's because it's an encyclopedia. And, you know, because of that, it didn't have to have big, I don't know, infrastructure costs or platform costs. He like totally glosses over the fact that, well, also because people volunteer to write the content, that's big, you know, like there's stuff like that where he just sort of he talks about Wikipedia's success in a very strange way, you know, as though it's just because for some reason encyclopedias are different from things that people are trying to do on the web, which like I would argue it's not that different from like journalism or, you know, other types of things. So yeah, it was strange to see Wikipedia come up. It only came up in sort of side mentions, I think. But it was always treated as sort of like the, oh, but this could never work type of thing. And the same thing actually was true of nonprofit models around web services, where he just like, he's like, oh, you could hypothetically fix a lot of problems that we see with big tech by having a more like nonprofit type of model or, you know, other types of models where the incentives are different, but that could never work. And he just like keeps going.
I was reminded of the member, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a thing called Scent that allowed people to purchase tweets.
Yeah.
As like,
it was like an NFT
as like
platform.
NFTs. Yeah. I think they shut it down, but like.
And they shut it down with like a pretty brutal condemnation of crypto and Web3.
Right. But I don't know if you guys remember, the reason that was such a big deal is because it, like the first tweet got sold for like $2 million or something like that. I just looked up the guy who bought the first tweet ever, and I found out that he fled Iran on embezzlement charges of $20 million in an Interpol red notice now. I don't know. I'm just like shocked by like how everything I think of when it comes to how NFTs were presented initially, it's mostly just bad news. And then to just hear all of this from you guys about this book, I think even the nicest review I read about it was David Z. Morris's, who is a friend of the show. And he called it an optimistic like take on the future of Web3. Which
can't
like
argue with that.
But yeah, to like ignore all of the bad things, all of the bad investments that Andreessen Horowitz has made, that Chris Dixon has made, and pretend like they didn't happen instead of saying like, here's what I learned from these experiences actually is pretty right. Compelling reason to not read this book for as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. There was also a pretty positive review in, I think it was Fortune by Jeff John Roberts, who he was pretty
shocking.
Positive about it, but he also very much called out the fact that like throughout the whole book, Chris Dixon is talking up Andreessen Horowitz investments without disclosing that they had invested in the companies. Like, they talk about Helium, they talk about OpenSea, they talk about all these different companies that Andreessen Horowitz had like major investments in, as though they are sort of not related, you know, as though it's just like, oh, I'm just picking an example, but it just so happens to be one that they invested in. And there is like at the very end of the book, if you go to the like about the author section, it says, you know, Chris Dixon is a general partner for Andreessen Horowitz. Some of the companies in this book may have been, you know, investments. And that's it. There's no list. There's nothing. Like, there's no disclosure.
I'm not saying that's illegal, but it kind of sounds illegal. But anyway, not,
but
yeah, probably not.
It's you're definitely probably unethical. Like, yeah. I have no problem saying that.
That's the perfect segue. There we go. That's the segue I needed. We're talking about unethical. So let's bring up how Anderson Horowitz and Chris Dixon got this book onto the New York Times bestseller list, which has been kind of the talk of the town for a couple days now. If anyone is unfamiliar, the New York Times bestseller list, it's the stalwart of, like, everyone turns to that to see what's popping off in fiction and nonfiction. And it's known as being this great source of knowing what is the most popular stuff right now in book selling. I know this because my mom was a bookseller, and I think the store that she worked for at the time was part of this, but they do a pretty thorough auditing. Like, they reach out to, I don't know if it's hundreds or thousands, but tons of bookstores across the nation and say, like, hey, we got to talk to you. What are the numbers you're getting? Anything weird going on? And if the booksellers say, yes, something weird is going on, actually, we got, say, 1,000 requests for this book, and we don't usually get anything like that, they tell the New York Times, and the New York Times kind of jots that down and says, well, that's weird. And when they publish their bestseller list, if they think that something weird happened and a book did something strange and suspicious to get on the list, they put a little dagger underneath the title, and lo and behold, Read Write Own had a little dagger underneath it, and it seems to, at least according to a Motherboard article, it seems to look like thousands of these books were bulk purchased, and essentially Anderson Horowitz and Chris Dixon manipulated markets so that they could get their book to the top of a bestseller list, as a marketing scheme, I would imagine, but right. Also because I think a lot of these guys are really obsessed with putting New York Times bestseller into their name. It's almost like a knighthood or something. So I assume that Chris Dixon's ego played a role in that as well. I think what's really funny to me about this kind of blowing up, there's two things that I think are funny. Everyone in finance already knows that A16Z does weird things when they invest in companies. I'm not going to call it anything else. I'll just say weird. Take from that what you will. And that the time that the public actually goes, oh, that's crazy, is when it's just book sales. Like, there's no way they lost that much money, maybe, you know, $100,000 or whatever it cost, right, to buy these books. I think Chris Dixon's time is probably quite valuable, at least to him. And so that has probably been quite expensive to put him on the book tour circuit and the podcast circuit. But yeah, the public, I think, is kind of loving to see venture capitalists make such an obvious mistake and think that no one would care. It just makes me reflect on, like, how they operate in general. I don't know. Do either of you have thoughts on that, on, like, this book as a metaphor and how it was published as a metaphor for A16Z?
I think it's really instructive quite how much Andreessen Horowitz, the company, is putting behind a book ostensibly just written by an individual general partner. Like, it's like they view it as sort of their book, and they have been putting enormous resources behind it, including, you know, full page print ads in the Washington Post, which are not cheap. You know, they were able to get a op-ed written by Dixon published in the Financial Times. You know, he was appearing on some of these very, you know, some of the most popular tech podcasts, at least in the US. They were clearly going, you know, pedal to the metal on the marketing for this book. And of course, what they did, you know, as far as trying to game the book sales. And I think that's really instructive that, like, okay, this is really important, not just to Chris Dixon and to his perhaps genuinely held beliefs about the future of the web, but also to Andreessen Horowitz, the company. You know, they stand to benefit not just because name recognition of one of their general partners, but because the book is itself sort of in furtherance of the goals of Andreessen Horowitz. But yeah, I mean, I think there is some irony that they were sort of doing this manipulation to do with a book that is about a, you know, an industry that is known for manipulation like this, you know, this type of thing, you know, that type of behavior, like buying all of something that you've released to try to make it look like there's so much demand. It's like, oh yeah, crypto, wash trading, like that's they do that all the time. It's not even unusual. Sometimes I forget it's illegal because it's so common in the crypto world.
So do they.
That's true.
Confess to it way too often for how illegal it is.
You know, I think there's a lot of irony there. I also thought there was a lot of irony around Chris Dixon's own description of crypto marketing in the book, where he talks about how crypto tokens and sort of the economics behind them incentivize this like organic marketing that people find really genuine, and you know, it brings in all this interest, which, like, first of all, genuine organic is not something I associate with crypto marketing at all. Like, I was like, oh, shilling, yeah, people love that. But also he's sort of in the book condemning the, you know, big marketing teams doing all this spending on something and it's so inorganic and inauthentic, and then like here they are buying crates of his own book or whatever it is. So, you know, I think there's a lot of irony there too, where it's like, oh, maybe you should have put the book on the blockchain and then you would have had people just shilling it for you.
I also find it a little ironic that they like, these guys are always talking about needing freedom and all of this in tech and in on the internet. And then when you look at who's getting these books on, when you look at who's like publicly posting about how much they love the book and how, like, several executives have posted on Twitter and been like, yeah, I'm making this required reading for my employees. And I'm like, well, so that's cool. Great. And like Jeremy Allaire at Circle, like, yeah, I'm giving this to all my employees. Like, okay, so they gifted you their investments like 500 copies, and the executives were like, yes, we have to make our employees read this, make them write a book report about it, which is just not freedom at all. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I will say it's not like super unusual for companies to like encourage people to buy the book that, oh, this executive just published this book, you should write it, or you should go read it, you know, go buy it, expense it even, you know, read it in your own time.
Write a review, which, like, on Amazon.
Yeah,
that's right.
Because there's nothing that employees love to do than go spend their free time reading a book about whatever it is they do for work. I do sort of wonder, like, how many people who are like, if you were to survey every person who read this book, how many of them were reading it kind of like under duress? Because it seems like a lot of the target market is like your company that Andreessen Horowitz invested in, and your boss just told you you have to read this book, which is like, oh, great. Changing hearts and minds out there, Chris Dixon.
To me, the book and its marketing reminds me of the long American tradition of politicians writing books. And politicians don't generally actually write books. They hire someone to write a book for them, and then they put their name on it, and then they have their foundation, like the National Party and a few other people, do a bunch of bulk purchases, and then it ends up on the New York Times list, and they get to take advantage of the book tour, of the book tours, basically extra earned media appearances that are campaign but not campaign to help get your name out there. I don't think Chris Dixon is running for office, to be very clear. I think Chris Dixon,
God, I hope not,
and A16Z is taking advantage of the fact that they've realized book publishers have long-standing relationships with publicists and bookers that make it easy, if you have a book, to get a bunch of earned media. And if that book is going to be a bestseller, people feel a lot more comfortable having you on because you immediately have a credibility marker on it. You're not just author of new book. You are New York Times best-selling author of whatever, you know? And so having you on, you're immediately more legitimate. It makes everything look more legitimate. And so I think what we're seeing, as we kind of mentioned before, this is a legitimizing effort. It's making sure crypto is still seen as a thing serious people can take seriously.
I think that's a really good point. Like, it would be really hard for, you know, Kara Swisher to be like, here's Chris Dixon in 2024. He's going to tell you all about how blockchains are the future. Like, just to say that, you'd be like, what? Why? Like, who cares? But now she can be like, he's got a book coming out. We're going to have him talk about this book that he's published, you know, and then it's like, oh, yeah, OK, I get it. You know, he's got something to talk about. And so, you know, he has this sort of excuse to show up on these podcasts and talk his book.
This is a digression, but some of those podcast appearances have been illuminating for me.
And I don't think they all went how he wanted them to.
The Hard Fork one especially,
yes,
took me back. Because I've had criticisms for the hosts and some of the things that have been said on that podcast. And
all before, of us have, for what it's worth, yep. I believe.
Before Chris Dixon was even introduced, both hosts were basically like, man, we said some things we regret during that.
Ooh, shouldn't have written that.
Shouldn't it have been, you know, just taking things straight from people's mouths? And then one of them was like, yeah, I was really listening a lot to Chris Dixon when I was saying some of those things I regret. Yes. Anyways, here's Chris Dixon. And it was this like hard pivot that and it was a relatively adversarial interview, more than I imagine Chris Dixon was expecting from Hard Fork. So that was just a striking moment for me in like how even as a legitimizing effort, this is not succeeding as well as I think he hoped.
Yeah, I have to give those guys a lot of credit for that. Like when I first saw like, oh, Chris Dixon went on Hard Fork, I was like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. Like these guys, like no way. Like I have had some very strong criticisms of some work by one of the hosts of that podcast, which I think we've talked about in this podcast before. It's Kevin Roos, the guy who wrote the New York Times. Latecomer's Guide to Crypto.
Yeah.
But I actually have to give him a lot of credit for his handling of that interview because he was very frank about, you know, he feels burned about some of what he, you know, he regrets writing some of the stuff that he wrote. He wrote a piece about helium that he talks about. Like he's still gets calls from people who bought those helium hotspots and they're pretty mad because there was a nice New York Times piece about it. You know, and they didn't completely flog Chris Dixon. I don't think they could have. It's, you know, that's, I think, a little bit uncouth to do that on your podcast, but they held his feet to the fire on some stuff. You know, they tried to get him to explain how helium was not a total disaster and he really couldn't. They ended up just being like, okay, let's move on.
Wait, it's uncouth to have a whole podcast episode dedicated to yelling about Chris Dixon?
Well, I think to have him there
if he was here. Yeah.
Good.
But I mean, if you can get him on, go for it.
No. This is not an invite for Chris Dixon for what it's worth. I think we're okay without having
something
him on and
tells
berating him.
He might not accept it anyway.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I think he has all three of us blocked on Twitter. This is not someone who is a big fan of ours. I think this is a two-way street when it comes to our feelings about Chris Dixon and his feelings about us.
I might have got blocked the same day that he said he wished crypto had better critics.
Better critics.
I remember that. He just really doesn't like critics. I think the last thing before we go that we should talk about is the NFT collection. So this book came with an NFT collection. In physical copies, there was a bookmark that was given to you. And they had a QR code or whatever that you could scan, and then you would get an NFT that you could get on OpenSea, which you mentioned is one of their investments. I think that's very funny. So it's basically just a way to get them on board people to OpenSea. And then they would get this. It's basically the cover of the book. And then it changes colors when you redeem it. And so far, this New York Times bestseller out of 5,000 NFTs has sold 281. And I think everyone should just think about what that means for Chris Dixon's thesis of his bestseller, which is that this is the future, that everyone should, you know, get into this. It's still very important. And there's two ways to look at this. Either he really did organically sell thousands and thousands and thousands of physical copies of this book, which I doubt that, but okay. If he did organically sell those physical copies, you would expect that there would be more NFTs that have been redeemed by now. I think you would also expect that to mean that the public seriously cares about the topic of cryptocurrency and blockchain and Web3 still. But instead, we've seen none of that in accordance to these NFTs themselves. None of these sales were organic, and why would anyone redeem them? They're all in a A16Z warehouse somewhere. But either way, that tells me that there isn't actually a lot of organic interest in what Chris Dixon is writing. And I think largely outside of like Michael Lewis writing Going Infinite, which is more so about a character in cryptocurrency than about cryptocurrency, people don't really care. And I think the really cool thing is, the only way I can say that without feeling weird about it is because he put it on the blockchain and everyone can check and see how many of his NFTs have moved. And there are very, very, very few of them.
Yeah, it's a win for blockchain transparency, I guess. There you go.
In Chris Dixon's defense, it's possible that even the people most excited about cryptocurrency and his optimistic view of the future still look at getting a picture of a sunset that changes colors that's the same as everyone else, basically, and think, this isn't worth the 12 minutes it would take me to figure out how to get my MetaMask set up and log into OpenSea and redeem it. Like, even the biggest fans of crypto might be like, you know what? That's too much of a hurdle for this specific prize.
It's just kind of like a gimmick, I think. There's no secondary market for them. So I don't think people are like, there's this whole thing with Gary Vee's book a long time ago. He tried to sell a book and he was like, if you buy 12 copies, I'll give you an NFT. And people started like mass buying the book because they wanted to speculate on the price of the NFT. I don't think that's a dynamic in play here, because I don't think anyone's like, oh, if I buy this book and get this NFT, then I can sell it for $100,000 in 3 years or something like that. So I wonder if it's maybe just not that compelling, or maybe all the sales were eBooks, because you don't get one with the eBook, as I discovered.
Well, I know that you have to sell a certain amount of physical copies to get onto the New York Times bestseller list, basically, as far as I understand it. I might be wrong, and if someone knows more about that than me.
But like at least the Vice article quoted saying like you sometimes need as little as 2,000 copies to make the list. And what Electric
Capital... I was surprised about that. I never knew that before.
Oh, yeah. Books don't sell. No one reads books. What Electric Capital alone bought 1,401 copies of the book. And so that gets you a big chunk of the way there. Add in a couple hundred Circle employees. I think all of these things illustrate there's not a lot of people who are interested in reading 150 or 200 pages about an optimistic view about what blockchains maybe possibly could, might, maybe do.
I do want to add that this NFT took 5 companies to come up with. These are like, these are like relatively large. So we're talking A16Z, which is massive in and of itself. Like this is a multi-billion dollar fund. Then we're talking IYK, Manifold, Dynamic, and Optimism. And these, for anyone who's not in crypto, they don't matter. But for anyone who is involved in this space, these are like, oh, these are the big companies. And what they came up with was a color-changing picture. And I think that just, it speaks volumes to the actual usefulness of this.
I agree with you that it is very funny that somehow this took 5 companies to do. Although I do think that it was maybe some overselling on Dixon's part, where like they listed Optimism, which is just the chain that they use.
Yeah.
I doubt like Optimism Labs or whoever runs that was like deeply involved. You think so?
Optimism has a tendency to send out lots of like their technical team members or at least money to anyone who wants to build on Optimism or do anything on Optimism.
Well, but Andreessen Horowitz also invests in Optimism. So I assumed that they were just like shilling one of their companies.
Absolutely shills to name the companies that they specifically had. And I'm 100% you're right, Molly. Yeah. Regardless, this whole thing has been hilarious to watch. It's like watching the richest guy you've ever seen just slipping and falling in the mud in his new white press suit. And it's just lovely. And I love it. And I'm happy it's happening. And I'm happy you reviewed the book and gave it a wonderful review. Everyone read her very kind to Chris Dixon review and lovely towards A16Z. I just want all the venture capitalists at like
Yeah, go out all there and read. Give it a read. Who made it to minute 60 of this interview?
Yeah, that's right.
You're adoring fans in the venture capital world.
A man can dream. All right. Yeah, Molly, is there anything that you, before we, you know, let you go, is there anything that you, I don't know, that you want to talk about in terms of your blog or anything that you're working on or anything like that?
So if you want to read my writing, citationneeded.news, you can sign up for a subscription, free or pay as you want. And then I also run the website, web3isgoingjustgreat.com, which is, you can just go look at that. It's, you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's going to do it. I guess everyone, I'm writing the new read, write, Cast Coin is coming out very soon, and it I'm going to be doing a book tour for it, and you're going to see it at number one on the New York Times list. It's, I'm not going for number nine. Screw that.
Next podcast is just going to be like crates and crates of books behind you.